We have had many, many coast-to-coast guests over the years who have just given us just amazing information. They have died. They have passed on. And I got to tell you, I miss them. I miss them all. They run the gamut. The list is just too long. But every once in a while, we will honor those guests with our special program on the dearly departed. Tonight, we will have six of them who have passed on over the years. I'll go through each one of them in just a second. And what we'll do, time permitting, at the end of the segment with that guest, is we will take your phone calls between you and me, and we'll chat about that guest. So get ready to make the calls. Our first guest will be Al Bielek, and we'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. I'm George Norrie. In 1943, the USS Eldridge and her crew were involved in a top-secret military project called the Philadelphia Experiment. The objective was radar invisibility, and the results were less than desirable and produced a series of just unimaginable events. Only a few men apparently survived the experiment. Two of the men had jumped from the ship and landed mysteriously on the Army base at Montauk, Long Island in the year 1983. They jumped ahead 40 years. This 40-year time and space leap that seemed to take just moments was part of Al Bielek's intriguing story. Now, we'll take phone calls from you regarding the life of Al Bielek as well right after this interview. Al, how are you?
I'm fine.
It's been a while. You know, when we last talked almost 2 years ago, someone had told me that you might have been involved in a car accident or something after that.
Yes, I was. I moved to Florida. And then there was a car accident in which I did not appear to be injured at the time, drove the car home. And that night after dinner, I had a strange tingling sensation on my right side. I did not know what it was. 5 days later, I found out what it was. It was the beginnings of a stroke. It was one of the next 5 days later in the morning, I rolled out of bed on the floor and couldn't get up.
Well, you're doing much better now, I hope.
Oh, much.
Excellent. Al, what is the latest now since the Philadelphia experiment of 40 years ago? Are things, has anything changed in terms of the concept of this experiment or things that we might not have been aware about of a couple of years ago?
Very little. The experiment, of course, took place. The original concept was from Dr. Nikola Tesla, honorary doctorate. And it was his idea. He sold it to Franklin Delano Roosevelt, 32nd President of the U.S. Roosevelt, through the Navy, supplied the money to fund the project. And he did the initial work, which was very successful on the first test, the first one being in the Brooklyn Navy Yard in 1940, using a small ship with a lot lower power than was required for the Eldridge. And, of course, there was also an interim test in which they were going to go to a battleship, and that was the point where Tesla bowed out. He says he wouldn't be responsible for killing sailors, but he said the power level was much too high with the concept of how to do it at that time. And so he bowed out, and Dr. John von Neumann took over, continued Tesla's approach, and increased the power somewhat. The first test on 15 July was quite successful with no side effects. And then, of course, came the fatal test on 12 August 1943 with severe side effects. And I might add, one of the big problems involved with this story is the concept that this was the USS Eldridge that was involved. It was not the Eldridge. The name was adopted later. By what means and how, I don't know, because there was an Eldridge launched in 1943, August 27th or 8th, from the Newark Shipbuilding Yards.
Right.
And it went to sea. It never took part in the Philadelphia experiment. It was never in the Philadelphia yard. And there's a long and mysterious story there because I ran down all the pictures I could find out of the archives, and they show two ships. There is a DE-173, which is well known, and there is a 173, which is an entirely different ship and structure with a knife plow front end, different superstructure, a number of different appurtenances were different. And that may have been the ship that was used, but my latest information is that the real ship that was used was supplied by the German government to the United States because it was originally intended to be a joint project between the United States government and the Germans. See, we were not at war with Germany in 1940 or 41. They turned that ship over to us in January, February of 1940.
I understand. Okay.
And we were on very good relations then. Of course, we got pulled into the war through the back door of Japan attacking Pearl Harbor. And then the liaison continued until sometime in mid-43 because I was part of that liaison with the German, not a naval officer, a German aviator who came over to Long Island. You can tell some wild stories about the German submarines coming up for the weekend off of Montauk Point on Long Island to sun themselves, charge their batteries. They'd wave at the people on shore, and the people on shore would wave back. It was a crazy war.
Some of the Germans even went ashore, didn't they?
They did, yes.
Unbelievable.
Now, it's unbelievable, is right.
In that time period, Al, you were someone else, right?
Yes, my original name was Edward Cameron.
Had a brother?
Father was Alexander Duncan Cameron, Sr.
Okay.
And he was in the Navy himself during the period prior to and overlapping World War I into the time about 1930 when he was retired from the Navy because of a physical disability.
The ship that you were on as Ed Cameron was which one?
Which was a German ship.
Okay.
So we have photos of the interior of that ship. I have them in my collection. And the interior ready room picture is much larger than those who investigated later to the real Eldridge and found that the real Eldridge didn't have a ready room that large and could not possibly have been that one because it didn't match.
Why did they or how did they try to ease in the Eldridge ship in this whole project?
I cannot answer that one fully. I don't know, except there was a great effort on the part of the Navy after this thing was over and they had so many disasters to cover the whole thing up, and they adopted the name of a ship which was known to have been built and existed, and they wanted to cover up the fact that the real ship that was used in the experiments was not an American ship.
They
conveniently, someplace, adopted the name the Eldridge, which was a provable American ship having been built in the Newark Shipbuilding Yards.
During the experiment, Al, the disastrous experiment, tell us what happened. Paint us a picture of what things were like.
Okay, well, we had a very successful test, and I said in July. Then they decided to change the requirements somewhat. They didn't require full optical invisibility. They only wanted radar invisibility because the thinking at that time was, you see, we had no satellites then and none of the other long-range navigational systems
right.
We have now. The statement was made that we do not want optical invisibility. We only want radar invisibility because if we have a convoy at sea at night and we have optical invisibility, we may ram one of our own ships.
Sure.
So don't want complete invisibility. We just want the Germans to be fooled into not being able to see our ships with by means of the radar. They had good radar at that time. So that was one of the reasons why they changed somewhat the requirement and cut it back so that it was only a requirement for the radar invisibility. So in the 43 test of 12 August, that was a requirement as modified. It would only be radar invisibility. That made some change in the requirements as to how the whole system was set up. But nevertheless, 3 days before the 12 August test, virtually everybody in the crew, it was a volunteer crew, and of course I was there and Duncan was there, and we were the ones chosen because of the fact we both had PhDs in physics.
And were you all aware of what was happening?
We were aware that something was wrong.
Okay.
We both had that gut feeling, as did some of the other sailors. And we used to bail out of the back gate of the Navy Yard to a diner that was down the road about half a mile from the back gate, and go in there at night sometimes and have coffee all night. It was open 24 hours then. And we would discuss this, and we all had this strange feeling that something was wrong, but we didn't know what. Neither Duncan nor I could put our fingers on anything wrong with any of the equipment. It was not the equipment. The equipment was working fine insofar as its design projection and its design parameters were concerned. What went wrong was the fact that due to the nature of the way the field was set up, and actually to describe it briefly, Tesla's original concept was to have a closed field like an egg around the ship, which would seal it off against any outside possible interference.
Totally engulfing the thing.
Totally engulfing the ship.
All right.
And there would be no problem to still have the invisibility that way, but it would lock out any outside interference of any kind. Well, pressure of the war and all of that, get something done, get it going as quickly as possible. He relaxed that requirement to allow a toroidal field, like a donut with a hole in the middle, and the Eldridge or the ship that was used would be in that hole, and it would be surrounded by a field which was in the shape of a donut.
Okay.
That left an open hole in the middle, and that is what happened, because the Montauk project, taking place 40 years later, overlapping a period of time, but particularly it was running on 12 August 83, and that was because of help we had from alien groups and how to make the whole thing work properly to what we wanted in 83. They had their own agenda, which was agreed to by the government, and they set up the requirements through channels that the final test would take place on 12 August 43, because the 12 August 83 was exactly 40 years later, and there was a synchronicity system involved here, if I may call it a system, a synchronicity aspect involved, in that you were dealing with the time fields of Earth and the fact that there's a phase shift every 20 years. And if you had it on a 40-year point, it was the maximum point where the Earth's fields locked in with maximum intensity, and there's a lot of very strange physics involved.
And it was like a closing window, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was actually an open window, which caught the Eldridge. Had the test been one day later or one day earlier, this problem would never have developed.
Right, the window would have been closed.
That's right.
Okay.
And so what happened was, the aliens had this thing turned on. They were using this to create a rift in the time field 40 years wide to allow certain of their ships from their home base to come in. They weren't after us. They weren't attacking us. They were pursuing a war which was going on in the solar system, involving certain of their ships and certain other enemies who we knew nothing about at that time, and who knows if we know anything about them now. But nevertheless, they got the ships through by creating that rift in the time field so that they could get their ships through, and that rift could only be created by locking up the two experiments, Montauk and Philadelphia experiments.
All right, so the
causing the huge rift in the time field 40 years wide.
All right, so a couple things were going on then. Not,
yes.
not only was the experiment actually occurring for radar invisibility,
yes,
but in 1983, this alien intervention needed to take advantage of the experiment as well.
Right. Now, I might add, of course, that those aliens were not somebody from outside, far away in space. They were all there by the invitation of the United States government. They were working on various projects for the government. They were helping us with our projects. And it was just that their price was they wanted to be able to use the Montauk facility for their own projects periodically. And that was agreed to in advance by the government not knowing anything about what they were letting themselves in for.
All right, let's get back to that in a second, because that's important when you make that time leap. So the experiment occurs, there's a disaster. Now,
yes,
what's happening to the crew before you and Duncan apparently jump ship? What's happening to the crew that was on that ship?
Several things. One, the field strength as embodied by the revised equipment by Dr. John von Neumann was so high that Tesla was afraid of it himself. And he said there might be a problem with dead crew members. What happened was it completely discombobulated the crews on deck, not those below deck, but the ones who are on deck who were stationed there as observers, such that they became partly invisible themselves. They also shifted. Now, no one on board that ship was supposed to become invisible, but the ones on the deck did become partially invisible because we were very close to inside the fields were being generated in order to produce the invisibility effect. It affected them psychically, it affected them neurologically, it affected their total body feel such that they started fading in and out of visibility, and then the ship was not locked exactly to that one location. It was not anchored by any anchor or anchor chain to the water below in the lower part of the harbor. It wasn't even in the harbor, it was downriver. The ship was supposedly stationary, but it was drifting.
What made you and Duncan jump off the ship?
What made us jump off the ship was, first of all, we were running the equipment. Everything turned on and started to work the way it was supposed to. But then we started to get some very strange electric fields inside the control room, which it shouldn't have been. We were getting high voltage walkovers from equipment which did not and could not produce high voltage. I was inside the control room. The electron tubes were banks and banks of 606G tubes, which those who are familiar with tubes will know what model and type that was.
Yeah.
It was quite prominent then. And those things were starting to get brighter and dimmer. The heaters weren't holding constant level. And then this strange high voltage phenomena seemed to develop, and there was some kind of strange arc over. Looking back at it, I can say it was not an electrical phenomenon. It was an etheric phenomenon which manifested in an electrical manner to us at that time. So we saw this. We were told prior to this experiment, if anything ever goes wrong, and we could not get any radio communication, that was shut off at the time, we said, frankly, we are on our own, and what we do is up to us.
Okay.
So we decided at that point, well, we better shut the equipment down because it's out of control. We can't control it. So we went for the control knobs and everything else, and they were frozen. We couldn't move a thing. So at that point, with this electrical phenomena, or what we took as an electrical phenomena, continuing to get worse, we simply didn't know what to do, and we finally got the bright idea as, well, there's nothing we can do in here. Let's go out on deck. And we did. We opened the bulkhead door and went out on deck. We saw sailors milling around in a very strange manner. Both of us got the idea, let's go to the railing of the ship, and we both got the idea simultaneously. And looking back on it, it was a little strange. We both had the same idea at the same time, jump overboard, because that was in essence a violation of orders. But of course, we were told that we'd be on our own.
Could you see the what the shape of that donut, whatever it might have been, in that green fog or mist that we hear so much about?
We could see the fog, but we could not see any kind of a donut field. We couldn't see the shoreline. We couldn't see anything beyond approximately, well, say about 6 feet beyond the railing.
Could you see the water down below from the top of the ship? You couldn't even see that. Okay.
No, the fog was so thick. When we jumped overboard, we were doing it on faith that the water was there.
Yeah.
And, of course, we never hit the water because the water wasn't there.
So you both jump.
Right.
And where do you end up?
We end up going through a very strange tunnel-like fields. And we're in sight of each other at the time. We finally wind up with a landing on our feet.
Well, I miss him. Al Bielek, what a great guest that he has been over the years. Sean in Miami, Florida. Sean, welcome to the program.
George, thank you so much for taking my phone call.
You're very welcome.
I'm a physicist that works with a dear friend of mine, Dr. Jonathan Zaslow. There are 790 properties that, how can I put it, that pertains to this particular aspect that we're talking about tonight. There's a Romberg philosophy that goes way back, George. And again, thank you for taking my phone call.
Mm-hmm.
I think folks look through the glass with amber views. It's an amber kind of distorted view. I have an uncle, Tobin, that is very slim, and there's 790, as I said, properties.
Well, I got to tell you, though, with what happened to Al Bielek, I don't think has ever happened to anybody else again. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you. I was privileged to have interviewed Robert Chapman. Robert was the owner and editor of the International Forecaster, which was a compendium of information on business, finance, economics, and social and political issues. He was a great Coast to Coast guest, and he, too, is missed dearly. Robert, tell me a little bit about how you got involved in economic forecasting. What transpired?
I think it was an evolution of my participation in the stock brokerage business. I was drawn to it by my experiences when I worked for the government in the middle and late 1950s, and I saw things going on that challenged me. I couldn't explain it. I didn't understand it. And it led me to get involved in the financial markets.
Once you did you see anything that was going counter to what so many of us in this country believed? Because as I just said, you're very unpopular in Washington, D.C., probably because you call it the way you see it.
Well, that's true. And what I saw back in those days was I could not put two and two together. Things were happening that were unexplainable to me, and I drifted into the answers finally, and then became very interested in gold and silver in the early 1960s.
You know, Bob, right now every American is concerned about the price of oil, gasoline. It affects all of us. And it doesn't seem to be, getting any end to this. Do you forecast the price of oil going even higher than it is now?
Yes, I do. I think that oil could sell for $45 to $50 a barrel pretty easily.
Oh my God.
And I think the main reason is what's going on in the Middle East. I think a lot of professionals see that there could be further problems, not only in Afghanistan and Iraq, but also perhaps in Iran and Syria. And, of course, they produce a great deal of oil, and they're looking forward to possible disruptions. So I think under normal circumstances, were that conflict in that region not going on, that oil would probably be selling at $25 a barrel.
Is this a good thing for the oil companies when we have this kind of conflict going on and they're getting this kind of money per barrel? Are they happy about all this?
I think it's a mixed thing. They make more money on the one hand, but it may rob them of access to some of their reserves if conflict spreads. So it's a two-edged sword.
Robert, I want to talk with you about a lot of things tonight, but one of them includes what's happening globally as it affects Americans, because I just have this feeling that the European market out there is trying to gang up on us. Is that a pretty accurate perception?
Yes, it is, and it's self-interest. The European Union wants to compete head-on with the United States. They now have their own currency, the euro. There's now 25 nations involved. There's an awful lot of loose ends in what they're doing. And I think one of their primary objectives is to make the euro the world's reserve currency. And how they would do that would be a first step, and that would be to get oil denominated in euros or in a basket of currencies as opposed to just the U.S. dollar.
Now, how would that affect all of us here at home?
Well, I think it would make the value of the dollar go down, which should anyway. It's being levitated to a great extent by interference by the United States government, and that is nothing new. It's legal, and it's happened many times before. We just saw a rally in the dollar from 130 to 119 versus the euro, and I think that rally is just about over. And those things just don't happen simultaneously. Usually in this kind of an instance, government pushes it that way. But I think that if oil was not denominated in dollars, it would really give the dollar a thrashing.
Well, you know, there was always talk that Iraq, for example, was going to switch its denomination of oil from the dollar to the euro, and now that seems to have stopped. And some say that is probably one of the reasons we went into Iraq. Were those very real possibilities, Robert?
Well, you know, it's interesting you bring that up, and most people don't know it. In fact, probably 99% of the people, and that is that Iraq, in fact, did switch in 1998 to selling oil in euros. And yes, that was a consideration, I'm sure, in Washington that brought about their invasion.
Now, tell us what happens when, specifically with oil, because, you know, I'm learning something from you tonight. What happens in oil if the purchase of, I guess, the purchase of oil is switched from dollars to euros? What's the structure here and the mechanism?
Well, it's not great in as much as you're just using another currency. the thing that is very important in regard to the dollar is psychological. It would be a sign that the dollar is no longer the world reserve currency, and that would make owners of dollars perhaps sell them and sell dollar-denominated assets and diversify them into assets in other currencies and gold.
And if they did that, what happens? What plunges?
The dollar plunges.
Okay, but I mean, to the guy at home, you know, you may say, so what? The dollar plunges. I'm still going out. I'm buying my stuff. I'm getting my food. I'm getting clothes. I'm having a great time on a weekend. Or does he really get affected by that?
Externally, no. Internally, yes, because he doesn't go external. Most people don't leave the United States. And so consequently, he will be affected as the dollar dropped and drops, inflation will rise.
Okay, so when we go into Iraq now, have we changed that already? Is the dollar back to its oil?
Is the dollar back to what?
In Iraq right now, are we still using the euro for Iraqi oil, or have we switched that back to the U.S. dollar?
We immediately switched it back to the U.S. dollar.
Aha, okay.
Yeah.
So in your opinion, is that one of the main reasons why we went into Iraq?
Yes, and I believe that even if troops were withdrawn via the CPA, which is the agency was set up by the United States government of Iraq, they will continue to disperse directly the oil revenues in the so-called reconstruction of Iraq. And they want to hold on to that because it's being looted.
One might say that this whole procedure then might have been smart business. You go in there, you protect your dollar, your asset, and you keep going. Yet others would say, no, that's very dangerous, and that's one of the reasons why terrorists can't stand this country, can't stand our guts. How do you pick the right side with something like that, Robert?
Well, I think in both instances you're right. The only thing is we're not supposed to have preventative wars. That's not something the United States has historically done. And I think it's very, very dangerous. And I really don't think we should be in Iraq. And I think that it's caused people outside the United States, some perhaps 85 to 90%, to take a very, very dim view of American foreign policy and the United States as a whole. As a matter of fact, I think, because of the lying by Washington, that it'll take perhaps 50 to 100 years for America to get back its the confidence of foreigners.
Well, if not the confidence, at least I think people to start accepting us the way that we should be accepted. And unfortunately, I agree with you there. It's going to take a long, long time before any of that changes. It's almost as if we're out there all by ourselves. So who's dictating policy now? Is it big oil? Is it the banking system? What's really the story here?
Well, I think it's a combination. You have large transnational corporations that do business all over the world. You have banking and the brokerage community, and you have government itself. People like to perpetuate themselves in office. So you have a number of factors driving this, and I believe that the American public is now catching on, and I think they have found that the war really wasn't carried forward with salient reasons, and the popularity of what's going on in Iraq now for the president has dropped considerably.
Now let's talk about what we're doing here at home. You know, we've got the $2 plus gasoline prices. I think most Americans would be thrilled to death if they were back to $1.50 or so. I'm sure it'll trickle down there eventually again. But with all this going on, are there views in this country where people would say, look, it protects American interests, let's go in there, Iraq has the world's second largest oil reserves, we now control it, and that's the way it's going to be? Should administrations have been a little more forthright, I think, to everybody and say, hey, this is what's going on? Because what also happens, Robert, is it makes you suspect with regards to terrorism, who's behind it and why.
Well, it's not saleable. And terrorism had nothing to do with what they were doing in Iraq, and that is now obvious. And yes, there are people in America, American citizens, who agree with the administration wholeheartedly, and they agree that we should go in and kill thousands of people so we can secure our oil pipeline. And I don't happen to agree with that. And I'm a veteran, and there's a lot of veterans who agree with me.
Is it true that the banking system around this world may be the puppet masters of what's going on here?
I don't think there's any question that they are.
When they are doing that, when they are manipulating governments, when they are controlling monetary systems, when they're dictating political policy, in which then governments go into wars, what's the downside for all of us? What's the danger here?
Well, the danger here is an expansion of the conflict just in the Middle East alone. And, you know, it could go on for a long time, even if they put Iraq back together, which was a which is a mixed creation of the British government many years ago. You would end up with three states, Shia, Sunni, and Kurd. And you'd be back to what one would call Balkanization, just like we have in the Balkans. And every time you have that sort of a situation, you have an easy chance to create mayhem. So if you want to start a war, start it in the Balkans. Well, nowadays we can also start it in the Middle East due to what the British did many, many years ago. And so how is it going to affect us? This is going to continue to spread, if not stopped.
You know, I've got mixed feelings about all this, Robert, because on one hand, I do know that there are some people out there that hate our guts and would do anything they could to disrupt our form of lifestyle. And eventually, as technology begins to become more accessible to people, somebody's going to get a hold of a nuclear weapon and do something, and we need to be careful about that. On the other hand, I keep thinking, have we developed the policies that create this hatred as well? And so I'm battling with myself. I just don't know. What are your thoughts on that? I'm sure you've thought about that.
Well, at least recently, we have created a situation where we are making everybody else disturbed. And yes, there are a number of countries that probably have nuclear weapons that we don't know about. And I think every time that you go forward with an invasion like in Iraq, you're sort of asking for it. And particularly when you're taking on the Muslim world, whether you like it or not.
What would happen if we merely backed out, just merely backed out of all these other countries, specifically our involvement in the Middle East? Look at the danger there, because we're relying so much on foreign oil. Or would they all be friendly to us? Is that naive?
No, I don't think it's naive, because let's go back to the situation prior to the invasion. I didn't see any giant threat, and I don't know that anybody else did. And I think things would go back to at least semi-normal to normal. And as far as us withdrawing, we withdrew from Vietnam, and it didn't bring the end of the United States government or anything like that. And so I think withdrawing from Iraq is not going to hurt anything. Maybe our pride, but that's about it.
He was right on, wasn't he? Bob Chapman. Ferris is in Philadelphia. He was quite a guy. Ferris, thanks for calling.
Yes. I don't know how to put it, but I can 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Zaz, Amber, Romberg, Slim, Tobin, Harry, 790. Those are words that are used in the military that depict financial aspects.
Hmm.
So, yes. What are your thoughts on that?
Now, tell me a little bit more about that, though. What does that mean?
Z to A to Z, back to A. Zaz, Amber, Romberg, which is a DNA kind of thing that they were doing back in the day in the military.
Is it code, Ferris?
It is. It is code. It is code. Zaz, Amber, Romberg, Slim, and then 790.
Well, I got to tell you, I don't know what that means. Spent 9 years in the Navy and never heard about that at all. I'm going to have to jot that down and go investigate that on my own. If it's code, I have no idea what they're trying to tell us. Strange, extremely strange. Up next, we're going to be talking with another coast-to-coast guest who has passed on. It is amazing how they live forever when it comes to the magic of tape, isn't it? David Flynn will be our special guest, and he has brought just incredible stories to Coast to Coast, so I'm looking forward to talking to David as we continue with our special tribute to some of those who have passed on. There have been many.
Coast Insiders, the new version of the Coast to Coast AM app is now available for iPhone and now Android 4.0 and above. Listen live or on demand, anywhere, anytime. Go to coasttocoastam.com and download it today.